Welcome to Season 9, Episode 8 of RBG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we talk weather and seasons in your gaming session. We also investigate Easter eggs, aka inside jokes, and other rewards in your gaming sessions. Again, welcome to Season 9, Episode 8 of RPG Circus. My name, of course, is Jeff, and joining me this week is Chris. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, pleased to be here.
Pleased to meet you, yeah. No. I'm pleased to be here.
Yeah, I think it's safe to assume that time has long since passed.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Paul could not join us this week. He had some sort of conflict, so that's unfortunate. I think we have some good topics. No real news, per se, that is news. I guess I should preface this that we've had a couple of requests regarding the Kickstarter. So we are going to try to move the Kickstarters to the end to see how we like it. I can't guarantee that I will. I only preference that just because it always kind of got me in the mood for the other stuff.
Well, it was a warm-up, ultimately, here.
But I do understand the people that did complain about it. So it's the best I can do. We'll see. But there's no news. I mean, if there is actual news that's non Kickstarter, it will appear here, people.
Absolutely. So. And most of the one, because I'm doing a quick check over EN World, is mostly new Unearthed Arcana.
You know, honestly, that's
PvP, and of course somebody did a fun little topic here that's apparently the Curious Case of the Violent Rabbit.
Yeah. So, you know, and I think that's what why I always decided that Kickstarters were news, was because most news items are like product releases, if you will. Like, oh, this thing's going to come out. Well, yeah. That's news. Yeah, it's new. It's industry news, to be sure. But then it's like, okay, well, it's product stuff. It's not, I mean, I find the Kickstarters more interesting because they're products that, in some cases, are from very small people that have no other exposure. It's not like, oh my God, WotC's going to release another player's handbook. I don't care.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't mean to be crass about that. I know some people will like, that's just wrong. You know, D&D is the classic. And it is. You know? Mm-hmm. And I have no qualms about that. I mean, even, you know, Paizo with Pathfinder. I mean, that's almost now I'm going to call a new classic, if you will. And even that, it's like, I'm not that interested. Although, I guess, what is it? Starfinder is their science fiction one that's supposed to come out, what, at Gen Con, right?
Yeah, Gen Con. They're going to be home with Starfinder, which is their space opera version of Pathfinder, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, I'm not sure how I feel about that.
You know, I'm gonna wait to see ultimately.
Yeah, I think a lot of it just has to do with, it's like, I've gotten to the point where, you know, even Pathfinder has too many skills for no purpose. I mean, I do say that is one thing. While, you know, fifth edition doesn't really blow my skirt up, if you know what I mean. At least I can understand why they kind of pared it down some. Because, I mean, even Pathfinder did that from 3.5. You mm-hmm. know, it's like, if you look at the Pathfinder list compared to the 3.5 list, it's smaller. But it still has some of the same problems. So, yep. Shall we get into the topic, I guess?
Yeah, let's give it a shot and let us know, audience, if you like what we did.
I'm sure there are people that are like, thank God you finally get to the meat and potatoes. Screw the cabbage.
Hey, you can't have... What's the old saying goes from Pink Floyd? How can you have your meat if you... No, you can't have your dessert
pudding.
If you haven't
you can't. How can you have your pudding if you don't eat your meat? Yeah.
Thank you. I think you're there. Perfect.
No. That's an Irish thing. You know, meat and potatoes, king cabbage. But anyway. Right on. I know. Because I know. I'm not a big... It's like, I love corned beef and I love potatoes, but I don't like cabbage.
That's fair.
You know. Give me some
cabbage
good.
Is an unusual food.
Well... Yeah, you know, let me put it this way. I don't like cooked cabbage. You know, if I have cabbage, like, and, like, raw cabbage or, like, coleslaw or other things, no problem. But cooked, especially the you know, corned beef, potatoes, and cooked cabbage, it's listless. No, this is not a food show for people just joining in.
Yeah.
So let's get into this first topic, which we were going to talk. Weather's in gaming. And I only say this because it's like every time of the year, I have this thing about calendars.
Mm-hmm.
I time in a game. And I don't care what game it is. It's either it would be at D&D or especially Traveler. You know, Traveler, you actually kind of need to keep a calendar because, okay, well, travel takes a week, so you need to know that. You know, people have, if they're paying on starships, you have to keep track of, oh, well, you need to pay your starship mortgage, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your starship payments. And, oh, yeah, you're going to, you know, this, you pay your berthing fee, and that gives you, you know, berthing fee for X number, to be there X number of days. And, you know, in-system travel takes forever. And, you know, basically, travel is one of the few games where the calendar becomes so important that characters really do age.
Absolutely. And on top of that, that's how you keep your profit margin up to snuff when you're stripping stuff from point A to point B.
Right. So, you know, and along with that, and I don't know, have you ever tried to do fantasy calendars?
I honestly usually cheat. I usually end up using the equivalent of either there's already a pre-built calendar or I end up using our Julian calendar ultimately.
Right. I mean, or some, yeah, but I'm saying you have used a calendar. Because I know some games is like, you know, you don't know what, you know, you don't even have a year. It's like, even if you just say the players start off at 0 year 0, it's 1 year after they started. I mean, that's even better than what I've seen.
Absolutely.
You know,
and again, that's how you get really cool holidays or other situations happening within your game.
Well, and you know,
like
that's,
you show for St. Olaf's Day, for example.
Yeah. And I think that's part of the thing. It's like, you know, every time, you know, Easter just happened yesterday from my time perspective when we recorded this.
Yes.
And even any of the holidays, I always think about that. I said, you know, there's holidays, there's calendar, you know, there's festivals, there's all kinds of stuff. And, you know, different locations will have slightly different ones. But let's say you were in an adventure and they had, you know, some adventure and you just had some sort of random holiday in a town, just some sort of unique holiday. What if they visit that town around the same time of the year? Shouldn't that holiday exist again?
Yeah.
You know, how do you know that happens? It's like, of course, you have to keep good Game Master notes at that point. But, and even... Mm-hmm. But even more so, it's like, you know, seasons, and specifically, you know, how seasons affect weather. Like here,
absolutely.
I mean, here in Arizona, for example, we do have a monsoon season where, you know, where things get really really hot, and I mean, we it has to do with the humidity, and we have all these violent storms.
Okay.
And we have haboobs, as they call them, where we have these huge sandstorms that just kind of go blow through. It's like you can actually, when they show it on the news, they show the news with the wide lens or the telescopic lens or the aircraft views, and it's just like it looks like a wall of sand up to about 10,000 feet.
Darn.
You know, I mean, it's just a cloud, and it's like sometimes they blow across, and it's like when you're in the road, you're supposed to just stop, pull over, and turn off your lights, because you don't want someone falling behind you and crashing right into you.
I can see that.
I know that sounds weird, but that's the way that works.
No, dude, I live in Canada. I come from an area that goes from plus 30 Celsius to minus 30 Celsius over the course of a year. Extreme temperature change is our bag. Right. In fact, I do a lot of work where my minions, for lack of a better term, are sent off to the far reaches of the northern part of the province. And one of the things they have to be concerned about is some communities are so isolated that you can only get there by barge or plane during the summer, spring, and thing. But during the winter, they end up setting up something called an ice bridge. Yeah. It's
no,
that.
I believe it. I mean, yeah, I think in the northern part of the U.S., I think like Montana, there's actually towns that, for example, during the year, the only way to get there is by train. There's no roads that go there.
I could see that.
You know,
and again,
you know, and it's like, I don't even know what they do in the winter.
Yeah. And because of this really crazy weather, between spring and fall, there's a season I like to call slush season, where it's essentially mud up there. And because of that, there's no bridge because it's melted, but you can't really get a barge up there because everything will get stuck. So they're basically isolated for like about a month and a half.
No. Yeah, there you go. But I mean, that's where, you know, so obviously with seasons, there comes the weather. And we're going to talk about weather first, because you kind of made it a little nice, which is great. And, you know, again, does a calendar have to play into effect? I mean, I remember some software a long, long time ago where it would like generate a calendar and like generate weather for the entire year.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, which is great, except for the fact that that's one place in the entire world. You know, you just assume that wherever the players are, that's what it's just gonna rain if it calls for rain.
Well, that's absolutely, like, you know, as much as I love Star Trek or other sci-fi, you're not gonna have one climate on one planet. Yeah. You know, just a simple change of 5 degrees meridian will change the weather patterns there, especially if there's like a mountain range or something.
Oh, I know. I mean, and if you've ever, and for those people who have ever taken basic geography,
mm-hmm.
they actually cover weather in geography. People don't know that. A lot of people I met. What does that have to do with it? It's like, yeah, it's important.
Yeah, well, dude, it's, I live in a place where there's a magical word called a Chinook, which you may or may not be familiar with. Basically, it's a warm wind that comes down from the mountains that basically gets channeled up there during the thick of winter to basically melt the crap out of things. And because of that, if you're close to the mountains, you're actually going to have better weather than when you're more further out in more the plains area of the province.
Right. Yeah. So, well, I mean, it's just like, matters. Well, it's just like, you know, when you actually study geography, they talk about how, you know, when a wind blows against the mountain and, you know, cold air condenses, which is why it sometimes rains on the leeward side of the mountain. Is that right?
When yeah, it does.
Leeward. Yeah, it rains more on one side than the other because of the way the wind blows, and the wind blows the air up to where it's colder, that condenses, and then it rains.
Yeah,
causes it to rain. Yeah. Anyway, but we're not going to get into the technical bits here, yeah. folks.
Trust me, I could do a lot of stuff here, but I don't think anybody here wants to hear about a Siberian high.
No. But you have some important points, and I always like, you know, first off, we all kind of just say, oh, it's the weather. You know, first off, I don't know how many times I've played where the weather just seems to be whatever. It's like you don't even mention it. It's like you don't mention that it's hot or cold or than normal. And I mean, this is not really that important, but it just always seems weird that, you know, when you're gaming, it's almost like everything is 76 degrees or something. And
yeah,
fair.
It's all relatively normal for the most part, yeah. unless the weather plays a plot line crucial element or is part of an interesting set piece, it's ignored.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that on any of that stuff is important, you know, because really weather can set a mood, so it can be a set piece, as you point out, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't imagine playing, I don't know, I mean, I think I've never actually looked at the Ravenloft material, but I'm just saying, you know, like in a setting like Ravenloft, I'm sure it's always dark, foreboding, and lightning, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fairly normal.
But could you imagine something like, let's say, the assault on Helm's Deep in the Lord of the Rings? Now, imagine what happened if it had been raining for 30 days. Nobody would have been happy. Not the invaders, not the thing there, and so forth.
Right.
And it probably would have made a really sucky battle scene because everybody would be sloshing around in the mud.
Yeah, you know, it'd be kind of like some World War II battlefields. No, not World
exactly.
War II. I was thinking
World War One, the trenches. Yeah,
the trenches, or even the Civil War happened. Some of those were pretty bad. It's funny.
Oh, yeah.
Just as an aside, folks, the end of the Civil War kind of predicted the type of fighting that we would be doing in World War One.
Absolutely.
You know, because they really started beginning. You start beginning to see the early bits of trench warfare at the end of the Civil War.
Yeah, there
the
was
U.S.
That
Civil War, to be precise,
yeah.
folks.
Exactly. There was that one town, I can't remember its name for the life of me, but
I
it was basically
either.
On a hill, and essentially it was a giant mud hole, and the Union troops had a hell of a time trying to even invade the area here. It had very much a World War One aspect to the sucker.
Yeah.
I'll try to find more details for next time if there's interest, otherwise we will carry on.
Yeah, but anyway, as we were saying, though, you know, it's like obviously rain or wind or just even blistering sun. I mean, you know, it's like sometimes it's, you know, people just talk about, oh, we took a trip in the desert. Well, what's the, you know, I always love that. It's the desert. Well, you know what? There's all kinds of desert. Just
mm-hmm.
because it's hot. You know, people, I don't know, when people think desert, I think they think of the classical high desert of,
the Sahara.
Lawrence of Arabia, yeah, the Sahara. You know, it's like, there's just sand, and it's hot. And, not quite. You know, as I can attest, I mean, we have, it is hot here, but we actually have periods where it's actually not that bad.
I can see that.
You know.
And on top of that, it's just, a lot of the times I think when it comes to basic mapping, like often they use a generic type temperature or phrasing for a particular area, like you said.
Yeah.
Like, for example, if you're going through a woods, it's going to be essentially springtime for all intents and purposes here. You know, you got relatively young frost, you're looking for fruits and berries because you need to forage. even though it probably isn't the right time of year otherwise.
Well,
And
and I think that's part of it too. It's like, you know, and I think that's where, I'm not saying you have to keep track of any of this stuff, but it's that's why I like calendars, because it's nice to know roughly about what type of year it is. Because even if you just assume that everything you're doing is in like a Earth-like northern hemisphere, you can at least say, okay, well, these are the summer months, these are the spring months, these are the fall months, these are the winter months, and you can kind of infer certain things wherever the hell you're at.
Like, yeah, definitely.
So go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry. Go on. Well, I found a blog who went through a full rant of this stuff on top of that. I think I added the link to the notes. And he basically went into certain points here, which may or may not be of interest, when trying to set with weather. Step one, build your weather a year in advance. If your location is going to be fairly predictable, then determine your weather a year in advance for as long as you think the PCs will be in the region. Like, bear in mind, this is assuming the PCs stay around the particular area.
Right.
As knowing adventurers, but, you know. This will at least give you an idea of roughly what the weather is going to be like. And, of course, weather should affect gameplay. Even if it's just pure color text. Like, there's a cool wind. Just something simple. And because it's a cool wind, it's not normally this cool in this area. Why is that? Is it because a wizard did it, or a druid? Or is it because, I don't know, maybe you pissed off the god of cold?
Well, that's actually the other fun thing. It's like, why is there weather?
Exactly.
You know, in your game world, it might all be, oh, the deities just enforce it. You know, I mean, you think of all the classical, I mean, we just use the, just take the Greek myths, you know. Why is there summer and spring and fall? You know, all that stuff. Like, you know, there's a whole mythology about that, even though it has no basis in reality, but it's
you know, it would be kind of a cool thing to do if you're going to go for a wacky weather pattern. Take the four humors that were used in ancient Greek medicine, but make them associated with the weather. Kind of, instead of blood, bile, you know, black bile, green bile, and phlegm, maybe based on the four elements. This is an earthy month, therefore it's going to be colder. Or this is going to be a fire month because the fire, you know, the fire elements are more likely to affect the environment. Therefore, it's hotter. Or this is monsoon season because the water elemental area, the gateways there are opening up and basically cause more water-based influence. Whether it's rain, whether it's a tsunami, whether what have you.
Yeah.
It basically uses those elements. Like, your weather isn't based on meteorology. It's based on frickin' portals. I don't know. I think it'd be fun.
Could be.
You know?
I do like your note here, by the way, where you had overview and you have getting lost. Because definitely weather does that.
Yeah, like, as much as I'd like to say we have, you know, we live in an era where we basically know where everything is. Because we have GPS, we have maps, we have compasses, and we have a lot of grids.
Well, you know, that's actually an interesting thing. People, especially when you wander without roads.
Mm-hmm.
It's like people don't really understand how difficult it seems. It's like, well, my players would be, it's like, you know, unless you're a woodsman, you direction is not something you comes natural to you.
No, definitely,
you know,
not.
I mean, some people, yes, but I mean, unless you live that environment, you don't get used to saying, oh yeah, this is the sun comes, you know, I mean, as weird as it sounds, even basic things like, oh, okay, you know, sun rises in the east and sets in the west, you know, kind of thing. It's like, oh well, we know we're, you know, we can kind of guesstimate which direction we're heading. I'm just going to follow the sun, you know, to head west, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, that's the reason why you want your roads and you want your milestones.
Yeah.
Saying that you're there and you're at this crossroad and you want to go over here and this is a rough destination. Because if you wander, say, a plains or a desert or what have you, unless you are able to find some sort of marker, it's very easy to end up running around in circles.
Well, I mean, you know, just getting things wrong. I mean, one of the things that people don't understand is in the United States, during the early Western expansion, if you will, there are surveyors and they're marking off points with lengths of chain, you know, to fix, you know, to divide up things. And so what's interesting is sometimes they were off. And so their marker spots, what are the hell, I forget what the hell they're called, their master markers, if you will.
Yes.
And technically that's a legal point in space. Nobody can change it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like there are notes like if that marker gets destroyed, there are notes on how to recreate where that marker is.
Yeah.
Anyway, so when you go across the U.S., there's actually these plots that are supposed to be square or rectangular, and they're trapezoid.
Yeah, because they couldn't keep all their numbers straight because, well, they were measuring with twine, for lack of a better term.
Right, they were just making errors. But it's like, hey, you know, it's not as easy. I mean, you think about even just shipping, you know, ship navigation. Why was the infamous ship's clock so important to navigation?
Yeah, because you had an accurate measurement of time when you were moving a material.
Well,
in fact, go on.
Well, I'm just saying, people don't realize that, you know, it's like finding where you are at, either north or west of the prime meridian, is all based off time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even your GPS still uses that same basic technology.
Yeah, because I remember, it's been a while since I've done my history, but I remember something in the back of my head, how somewhere in Britain there was this big fight between the clockmakers and the specialists, for lack of a better term, for tracking purposes there. Because they were fighting tooth and nail to not open up this very specialized skill when it comes to navigation.
Well, part of it is the gentleman who created the ship's clock was, I don't think he originally was even a clockmaker, but the Royal Society, there was actually a contest to actually figure out
that.
Exactly. And, you know, so they had all these academics and they were trying to come up with all these weird charts and tables based off of points of like where Jupiter is in the sky and all this other stuff. And so it was a very complex process.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, along comes this guy with a fairly accurate clock that you could put on a ship.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, his original one was actually like a larger clock, and eventually it shrunk down to the size of a really, really large pocket watch. And that's why, in naval terms, it's weird. They still talk about winding the ship's clock.
Interesting.
You know, that was one of the things that you, you know, when you would do certain reporting, even in the U.S. Navy, at least when I was in, there was still a line where they would talk about how the watches were wound and compared.
Nice.
And the idea was that is so important to know because the ship's clock would be set at prime meridian.
Exactly.
So since you knew the time there, if you knew, like, so if you know when sunset rises, you know, when sunset rises, you can compare it to where the time is on your clock, and then you can actually figure out how far you are east or west of the prime meridian.
Yeah, because it's based on time zones. That's actually kind of brilliant when you think about it.
So, I know, that's an aside for people. You don't need to use that in your game. But that stuff is so interesting that we do that. But, you know, so getting lost is really easy, and of course, with weather, it's even more so. But it's something that I think when we game, we kind of take for granted. When the earlier games, especially like early AD&D, I think there were rules to deal with that because I don't, you know, the miniature influence on gaming at that point. You know, we kind of moved away from that. We're kind of moving a little back. And I know a lot of people are like, well, that's something I just don't want to screw with. Yeah, but if your players can't get lost, how do you explain that they got lost?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm just lost now. Well, why? You know, I mean, I don't know if I was a player. It's like if my game master said, well, you guys got lost. Well, how did I get lost? I'm the nature guy. You know, exactly. For example, how did I get lost? It's like you have to have an explanation. And weather, honestly, is a good one.
You Absolutely.
Know, it's like, you know, it blew over the tracks. You don't see the road anymore. You know, the mountains all of a sudden, you find, because of fog or whatever, you walked around in a circle, you got lost, and it's like you kind of know what direction you're heading in, but you don't know where you're at on the map.
Yeah, like your first priority would be find some sort of marker or identifier so you at least know where the area is. Like if you show up at a small village in the middle of nowhere, at least then you know where you are.
If it's even a known village.
Yeah.
And that's actually a great hook. You find a village that, who are you guys?
Well, heck, that's the entire freaking plot line of Ravenloft. You go through the mist, you end up in another world.
Well,
and, you know, it's more magical and basis than weather, but still fog.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, you list some great natural disasters, by the way. I like it. Blizzards, dust storms, flooding, fog. Forest fires. You know, that's actually an interesting one. Because a lot of people, you know, when they watch the news and it's like, oh, there's a forest fire. That's like, and it's always man-made, it seems. But The funny thing is that they're not always man-made. lightning strikes the ground, it's dry, it actually starts fires. And oddly, this is what people don't, that they're just finally start, well, they're starting to do it, at least in the U.S. Forest Service, because they used to set prescribed burns. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of weird where it's like, well, we're going to stop this forest fire. And it's like, not all forest fire is bad. Actually, in nature, there are certain forest seeds that don't actually get released until it's burnt.
Oh, absolutely, man. I grew up with the fire cycle.
Yeah, exactly.
The area I live in is basically described as the boreal forest region in Canada. There is a actual need to burn mass amounts of forest within certain areas naturally.
Yeah.
And if you want to see what happens when they don't burn it for like a century, do you remember the Yellowstone fires that happened back in the 90s?
Sounds familiar, but I don't remember them, unfortunately.
Okay, long story short, around 94, 95, there was this major forest fire that basically, because there was like 80 years of growth, and when it comes to coniferous trees, it's like a giant match.
Oh, yeah. No, people, I mean, again, yeah, that's people don't get that, so. Oh, exactly. I like the one you have highlighted, hurricanes. I've lived through a few.
Yeah, and again, what are you supposed to do? Like, in my humble opinion, if you have an event and you survive it, you should get experience. You know, but it's got to be a man versus nature experience, if that makes any sense. Like, there's got to be some sort of risk because of it. But you can't tell me that surviving a hurricane when you bolt down everything and because you had the proper skills isn't worth XP if you're fighting a bunch of orcs as your alternative.
No, yeah. I think that's where, especially from a D&D standpoint, I mean, we still get, I think 5th edition still gets experience points for killing things, and 4th edition, then they had encounters that you guessed, I think there were encounters that you just got experience points for. I think that's one of the reasons that I've almost always in gaming, especially D&D, when I was doing D&D, I kind of fell under the category of what happened in the adventure, and I just give you XP for that. I don't really care how many you kill or why you kill it.
Precisely. That's kind of when you use a more milestone method. Yeah. Did you do this, that, and the other thing? Great, you're up a level.
Well, and I mean, if you take games like Savage Worlds, it's just like you assign XP based on what happened in the adventure.
Oh, absolutely.
And most adventures are usually 1 to 2 XP anyway. And it takes you 4 or 5 adventures to gain anything. So,
yeah. But like you're saying, okay, let's say you're involved in a forest fire. They're going to burn down a village. You get involved in setting up the firebreak. Okay, and you still have to dig the thing. You roll your skills, you roll your sets, and you save the village. That's what big damn heroes do. And because of that,
or somehow find or get the population to safety in some other way.
Precisely. And
I mean, and then if you really want to be nasty, you throw in some marauders who just want to kill everything as they're being driven out of their town.
Exactly. Basically, you got to defend the yokels against that thing as they go through there, or through a sandstorm. Or one of the nastiest experiences I have lately, as we just got out of winter, sleet. What if the rain is cold enough when the rain hits, it basically freezes on the ground. And I don't know about you, but I've driven in sleet weather. It's ugly. Because you're basically driving on a skating rink.
I've never driven on sleet, but I have driven on compact snow.
Mm-hmm.
One year when I was traveling, the state of Texas ran out of snowplow budget for the northern part of the state. And I think, I want to say Oklahoma did too. It took me almost 12 hours to get from Oklahoma City to Amarillo, Texas.
Damn.
Because we were going only like 20 or 30 miles an hour on the road.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
And it's fun. Like, no, I mean, you couldn't. I mean, everyone was traveling that fast. And it's funny because you'd see these guys in these big four-wheel drives think, oh, I'm going to go in this other lane and I'll be fine. And, you know, an hour later, you'd see them off, you know, off the road. And yeah. Or you'd just see people, like, pushed off, you know, lost control of the vehicle for whatever reason. They're off on the side of the road. And you can't help them.
No. If you help them, you're pretty much kapunk yourself.
Right. And it is the most soul-wrenching thing ever. It's like, you realize that if you help them, you're stuck. You've just compounded the problem because you do not have the equipment nor the skills to help them get out of their situation. And if you go there, you're going to stop. And when you stop moving, you're going to get stuck.
Precisely. Unless you're a bunch of adventurers, in which case with the right equipment, Like, as silly as that movie was, I'll give Sharknado credit. They had the right equipment on their freaking vehicle.
You know, that's one that I've never actually seen.
You know, it's horrible, it's thing there, but every consequential action in that movie can be described by a single word: adventurers. Why are you rescuing that bus full of children? Adventurers. Why are you trying to get everybody to safety? Adventurers. Why are you trying to go against sharks with chainsaws? Because adventurers, let's be honest
Because
here.
I want to be a big damn hero.
Exactly. And it's kind of like, you know, if you that's the game you're going for, do it. It's fun. Just realize it's not really based on reality for the most part. And, you know, just stuff like that makes it more interesting. Because otherwise, the big concept problem with weather and the big cautionary tale I'll say is make sure it doesn't become boring. Because, you know, if you're going to be stuck in mud for a month, you almost need to press the fast forward button to some degree, unless there's actually something else happening.
No,
You know?
I can agree with that. It's interesting though, because I think of Aaron Alston's advice in Ninja Hero one time, which was when he was talking about combat. He said, you know, and he was talking always like, always keep it interest, you know, keep it interesting. He says, what's more exciting? A some sort of fight in the middle of a street or a fight on top of a train?
Exactly.
And sometimes that's how I feel about, you know, obviously weather is one element into that. It's like, well, what's more exciting? Fight on a street where nothing's happening, or, you know, a fight on top of in a street where, I don't know, it's raining, it's sleeting, maybe fog. So as you're moving through, people come and go in the fog or something,
Or
or
how
just.
about you're trying to assassinate somebody and you show up that one day to get him on the day of the big parade and it's raining? That's gotta suck. Besides, the weather conditions aside, you probably can't get a clear shot now.
Well, heaven forbid if you're using like, and that's actually another interesting thing. Bows and arrows don't work well, really well in the
Oh no. Basically, they're glorified wood and absorbs water.
And
And.
actually, if you get technical, early muskets didn't either.
Oh yeah, well yeah, they're little fire compartments.
No, but I mean, it's just, I mean, when you look at that, it's always fascinating that we kind of gloss over that there's technicalities in gaming, or you
Exactly.
could be in the middle of a raging, obviously, rainstorm or thunderstorm or whatever, and it's like everything just magically works, even though it probably shouldn't.
Yeah.
And
Or my first.
I'm just saying that because it's like, it's where, and don't get me wrong, folks, I'm not trying to say that we should inject that much reality into our games, but it does give you pause sometimes where you're like, huh, if this was really going on, I would probably be doing something different.
Well, my personal favorite is actually a Dark Sun campaign I was in a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, where you had to rescue a bunch of people, you know, a slave city. And the group originally expelled the Gith Marauders from there, and they basically only had two casualties because of it, which was pretty damn impressive. However, when they went charging after them, they had a sandstorm, and the Gith were able to double back and take out a sizable chunk of the population because of it. Because, you know, everybody was bunkered down in their freaking tents.
All right, why
So,
don't we
yeah.
talk about your weird weather? Because you have a few, and about three of them are for three of them are actually rain.
Exactly. Well, the thing is with rain is it's liquid, which means it doesn't necessarily have to be H2O. It could be sulfuric acid. It could be ammonia. It could be almost anything. Or
Which
if you start
actually,
playing with magic.
well, it doesn't even have to be magic. Think about if you're in a science fiction campaign and you're on a world. That could be interesting. Of course, that would have to be a planetary feature that you would have to have known about. But, and that's the other thing. Obviously, if you're in a science fiction game where you go to a different world, weather, especially if, even though it's unrealistic for a planet to have only one type of weather, it's kind of what we do in science fiction. It's the garden planet. It's the water world. It's the jungle planet. Why, you know, just, you know, we do those type of things, and but it's important, you know, where it's like, okay, that just kind of gives you a rough feel for the world. You don't really care. It's kind of like science fiction is like the gaming map on a scale. It's like I've gone through this forest text, so it's all the forest is the same, no matter where you are on the planet, kind of thing.
Exactly.
So.
And, well, you can do a basic skidamarink, but oddly enough, I think Star Wars handled it, even though they had a lot of hats. The one thing I noticed a lot of is a lot of the planets were actually moons, which means they have smaller diameter, which would explain why they're a little, you know, why they're a specific weather pattern. Like the it was the forest moon of Endor, because it probably was only about the size of a freaking moon in our own world.
Yeah, that's funny.
You know, it just, I don't know, food for thought.
But
but
anyway,
yeah,
let's get back to the rain. So you have some interesting choices here. You have acid rain, infused rain, shadow
yeah,
rain. What exactly is shadow rain?
well, imagine, well, a lot of my concepts are based on the idea that if you add magic to any weather condition, it becomes weirder. And imagine a rain that's based on shadow essence. Maybe you have like an umbral shadow connection to the shadow realm or something. And if it drops onto the people, what if it turned people into shadows? What if it made things more gloomy than normally? What if it, when it, the drops congealed on the ground, they basically became giant shadow monsters, or like a shadow pool that basically charges around like the blob? And, or you could just take a good old-fashioned D&D spell and basically give it a precipitation feel, like stinking cloud bank.
I like that one, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, like the idea of taking the simple spell of stinking cloud and making it into a fog base, because magic.
Yeah, well, you never know. I mean, and obviously on a, especially on a, I mean, especially on a world that's been ravaged by magic for some reason, stuff like that. I mean, 'cause wasn't one of the settings kind of, wasn't fourth edition kind of a quasi, like, correct me if I'm wrong, 'cause I didn't play fourth edition at all.
Oh,
But
no worries.
wasn't one of the concepts like some sort of apocalyptic event?
Well, the kind of the idea of the world was the primordials came in first, the gods beat the start of them and locked up the worst of them. But because it's based on the primordials making a planet and they didn't like it, they wanted to destroy it. It was only due to the gods' intervention that they managed to fix everything, and even then, only so far. Like, that's why you had good and evil gods teamed up against, well, ancient primordial beings. And that's how you were able to have something that was chaotic evil and lawful good on the same side. Because the choice between that and oblivion, guess which side you're going to pick? And, you know, it's stuff like that. Or, like you said, one of the coolest things, and I didn't even add this here, is when you go to another planet, you can come up with some really weird crap. Just look at our own solar system. There is an ice volcano located on one of the moons of Saturn, which is just insane and sounds fictional, but it's true. Or what if you're on Mars and trying to climb Mount Olympia, which is the tallest mountain in the solar system? Or what if you get stuck in the perpetual hurricane of Jupiter?
Yeah.
You know, really changes elements here. I got one last thing I wouldn't mind throwing that I forgot to put on the list.
Sure.
It's a real interesting shorthand that I heard a while back, and I'm going to bring it up here. If you're not sure how to do anything with the weather, take a monster and base it on it. Basically, take a monster and use that as your weather base. So, like a dragon or a hydra or something. And then instead of actually, you just reskin it to be a certain bad weather pattern. And it adds an element and gives you an experience gauge in order to work with stuff, or, you know, based on whatever mooks or creatures you're trying to deal with. Like, I haven't actually used it myself personally, but I've been itching to try.
Huh, I've never heard of that one, so that one's interesting. So I'm gonna remember to include the, you have some links to some random weather tables for people to use if they want.
Oh, and I also have one last one that kind of tells tail off your previous thing. I found a Huffington Post article on how the Canadian-U.S. border was defined. And while it's not technically weather, it shows how imprecise things were in the 19th century when they set everything up. So I think it might be fun for a laugh.
I'll have to remember to include that. So the next one, the weather one, was kind of my topic. Obviously, you did a lot more research on it than I was going to talk about, but hey, whatever.
No, it's all good.
But we have Easter eggs in gaming, and specifically, you were talking, you know, inside jokes, hidden messages, and you have secret feature of interactive work.
Yeah. Well, again, it was Easter, and I was trying to think of an Easter-related topic that was a little different. And so a buddy of mine at work brought up the concept of Easter eggs and, you know, video gaming. And then I thought, wait a minute, we built that. We did that first, you know, in tabletop. And I'm sure other people have done it before, but it's kind of an international intentional inside joke, hidden message, or secret feature of a work. And, you know, it's one of these things that keeps a writer in the loop adding their inside jokes. And examples of this include legacy characters like the original Circle of Eight was Gary and his buddies, or the Defilers or Kevin Symbiota's group for the Palladium Fantasy role-playing game. Also, sometimes you can do a personal shout-out to a real person. Like, this is when writers put themselves in their own product, or they shoot a shout-out to a buddy of their mine, or when an artist draws himself and puts him in the artwork. You know, that.
Well, that, or just, even you take D&D, some of the original spell names.
Yes.
I mean, what was the original spell name for Acid Arrow?
Melfs.
And what did that stand for?
I have no idea. Do tell.
It was actually somebody, one of the characters' names, and he just basically, the legend goes, and I have no idea if this is true, but this is what I've always been told, so I call it a myth.
Fair enough.
That it stood, the guy whose character was Melf, he was playing an elf, and he was a male elf, and he just called it Melf.
Cute.
I have no idea if that's true, but I just always thought that was funny, if it is.
Well,
and I like to think that it is.
Even if it isn't, it's entertaining enough to exist.
But I'm just saying, so even if that's not an Easter egg, that's a legend around something.
Exactly. And or my personal favorite, going to go for the old D&D stuff, is Bigby.
Oh, yeah.
How many bloody hand spells do you need?
As many as you can. I always remember the cartoon in the AD&D manual where it's like, it's either a +2 back scratcher or it's a 1 that casts the various Bigby hand spells.
Yeah, I love crap like that.
Uh-huh.
Oh, and by the way, Rob Kuntz was the original creator for Bigby, showing that, you know, basically these legacy characters were based on the original party of the thing of the same name.
Well,
and of course.
Yeah. Of course, that's going to happen.
And again, that's why you do some of the stuff. Sometimes. And, of course, the third one is when you decide to throw in a cheesy pop culture reference, either through movies, books, comics, or other RPGs themselves. Because the hobby has been around long enough to actually allow some of this stuff to happen. And it's fun! Like, crap like that is some of the reasons why you read the books in the first place, even though it probably doesn't improve the product all that more, per se. But it makes it more fun to read.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm thinking of a weird Easter egg where, I mean, sometimes there's just weird references within a book, you know, like a game book, that references mm-hmm. something old that happened. Like, Group Didis Publications produced the Starship Operator's Manual.
Okay.
And they had, like, these little sidebars for the old-timer who would give advice, basically talk about various sections. You know, like, one section would talk about, you know, the controls, and he would talk about, you know, how you have these control panels that you can configure and what he would do and what he wouldn't do. And the funny thing is, I remember reading one of, was it the Traveler Digest, I think the magazine? Or what the hell was it?
Okay.
Traveler Journal or whatever. I forget what it was, which one it was. But whichever, because they eventually made the Mega Traveler Journal. I think it was the Traveler Digest. Yeah, the Traveler Digest. And in it, somebody actually asked them, it's like, is this guy, the old-timer, like this guy who was like some reference, you know, like some rumor guy in one of the other published, you know, GDW adventures? And they're like, funny you should ask that. Yes. We based it off that guy. And I'm just right, like, yeah. And I mean, that's a weird inside joke almost. I mean, it is an Easter egg because it's like somebody actually thought about it. Like, this guy sounds like, I mean, some of the stuff he's describing sounds like this guy that was in this adventure. And it's like, that's where they got the inspiration to have that old-timer.
That's awesome, pure and simple. Like, again, that's part of the fun of doing some of this stuff. Like, and it doesn't necessarily have to be just from the products you're reading. I know a lot of GMs that pull in legacy characters from previous games, or let's say they were watching Armies of Darkness, and suddenly Ashley Industries shows up in your game. You know? Because, you know, you're a fan of the stuff, and you don't have to worry about copyright infringement.
No, and I think that's been going on forever, you know.
Oh, I think it's going on long before gaming, they've been doing crap like this.
Well, not only that, I mean, let's face it, how many people have made adventures that are based off of movies? I mean, that's not a major, or books or something. And it kind of gets a little weird, especially when you're first playing game mastering, when you do that as a DM and people like, yeah, it's not the movie, folks. You can't actually role-play the movie. You maybe can use some stuff from it, and people mm-hmm. do. And it, those are kind of things, or as you, you know, especially, I mean, Monty Python and the Holy Grail is so prevalent in gaming, you almost cannot, I don't want to say I've never met a player, a gamer that has not, couldn't quote Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
But they're relatively rare.
I would say 90%+ could.
Absolutely. And
first off, it's just funny. I don't care what anyone else says.
Okay. And like I said, if you ever go to a convention and scream out, bring out your dead, see what sort of response you get.
Yeah. So, but I mean, when people game, it's like, you know, those things crop up. It's like, I don't know how many times I've seen, you know, obviously, you know, the bunny crop up. Killer bunnies in various forms and in various games.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, you look at Gamma World. I swear, some of those, yeah, some of those bunny creatures are based off of that.
Absolutely, it's a freaking legacy monster now at this point. Yeah. Like any roguelite adventure game, often has a Vorpal bunny as some sort of monster in the end. You know, one of the relatively high level suckers, because well, one text is as good as another, and it's an incredibly silly yet scary monster because of it. And again, like, I'm going to give a few examples here, but such as Car Wars, which the ADDA office is located in Austin, Texas, which is where Steve Jackson Games takes place. That's where the main location is. You know? Or Lake Geneva. the real life home of TSR back in the day, was the site of one of the few successful nuclear strikes in the Short Wars, now a glassy crater, home of the popular Divine Wrath Amusement Park. That's the stuff that's really entertaining here. Or my personal favorite recently that I was finding when I found a few websites to get some, you know, want to hear other people's stories as well. There was this D20 product called Cityscape, where the tavern names were actually drawn from the infamous Random Harlot table in the original first edition Dungeons Master's Guide. Like,
Random Harlot table?
Oh yeah.
I have to pull up my DMG for that.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to cross-reference that just to see if it's actually true or not. Like, a lot of these might be rumors. I don't promise these are true. But hopefully they're entertaining.
But you see, that's kind of the fun.
Exactly. You know, like the old man says, everything is true. Even the lies, especially the lies.
Well, you know, there's an old saying. The truth is just a lie we all swear to.
Or my personal favorite, keep your lies consistent. Fergie's Code of Acquisitions. Yeah. Other stuff includes Final Fantasy. There was a really awesome book back in the 80s called The Riddling Reaver, which kind of dovetails back in the old thing we did, that bundle of holding that happened there, where it shows Ian Livingstone and Steve Jackson as guests at the Reaver's banquet table, preserved in glass jars. That one's true. That one, I actually own the book there, so it's actually kind of entertaining. Or GURPS, where it has in its index Fenord. Now, when you look beside it, instead of having a page number, it says you're not cleared for that. Because it's based on the original Luminescence trilogy, to kill the joke, so to speak. And it's just stuff like that makes gaming fun to read. On top, it almost adds like a metagame element to the game. And I would recommend any gaming products, feel free to throw in a couple things here and there, because if nothing else, it'll make it more entertaining for you to write.
By the way, I like your 4th edition Gamma World note. That's funny.
Just what is it?
The Gamma World note that you have in here for 4th edition.
Oh, the 4th edition of Gamma World has a few, most glad being Mayberry's Overlord of Bombier, Aunt B, Diddy, Taylor, and others living in a peaceful little town in the middle of Gamma Terra. Yeah.
That's bad.
That was just silly, but that's what's fun, man.
Yeah, I think a lot of gamers are into puns, too. Even if they groan at them.
Are you kidding? I think gamers are fueled by puns. Heck, in our game yesterday, we ended up getting stuck in a whole stream of bear puns. Don't ask, we won't tell.
I won't.
Yeah. Let's just say, never get gamers on a one-track mind. or you might regret it. But anyway, it's just stuff like that.
Well, you know, that's the other thing, too, is, you know, some of the stuff is just within the group, your own group. There are in-jokes, and stuff just comes up, you know.
Absolutely.
And it's like, you know, because I've joined a group, and I don't know. It's like, there are, like, weird items, and you're just like, everyone's laughing. You're like, what the big deal about it? And they can't explain it to you because you weren't there.
No, and you want that because it acts as connective tissue for your gaming group.
Right.
Like, I'm sure the original gaming group that had the gazebo incident will never forget the story. Hell, we won't even forget the story, and we weren't even involved.
Right.
And that's part of the fun.
It's a gazebo. You know, and some of that, and it's fun, those just misunderstandings.
Nothing.
You know, I mean, God knows I've created some of my own moments like that.
You know, oh, absolutely. You know, in fact, that actually dovetails nicely into what I was going to ask you.
Yeah.
Have you ever used an Easter egg in one of your games? If so, what was it?
Actively these days, I would have to say no.
Yeah, that's fair.
You know, I mean, when I was younger, yes. Probably the closest to an Easter egg that I've ever had in a game was... my player said something stupid about some creature that phased, and I just said something about making it into a jockstrap.
Nice.
And so when we finally killed this phasing creature, the game master actually had me make a jockstrap out of it.
Okay, that's funny.
And so it was even funnier because, I mean, this was a Traveler game. And... so, somewhere along the line, we were boarded by some pirates. And so, it was just my character in a jockstrap with a railgun in a hallway.
Ah, that's cute.
You know? And it's like, yeah, you guys, that's the last thing you guys see.
Oh, absolutely. And so. Again, that's crap like that is what keeps gaming fun, even if it's outside the suspension of disbelief.
Yeah.
Like, people poo-poo metagaming, but I think this is metagaming in a totally different way when you start adding Easter eggs and stupid meta jokes, especially if it fits the feel of the game.
Or just the people that are playing it. Yeah. You know, I mean, you know. I don't think it necessarily has to do with the game, but the people you're playing with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a joke among friends, you know.
Yep.
It's kind of like having nicknames for people that it's like, why are they called that? I don't know. That's just what they grew up calling the guy for some reason.
Yep. It might be like, a story behind it.
Well, I'm just saying, I remember, I don't know, it was my brother-in-law that my sister married, where his family had a lot of friends, and they had like a lot of their friends had like little nicknames for them. Like they'd call like one guy Scooter. It's like, why is he called Scooter? That's not his name. You know, and it was an in-joke from when they were growing up together, some event that happened. They just start calling him Scooter after that. And everyone in that group had, like, some sort of weird nickname that people called them.
Absolutely.
So, and so, obviously, that's an in-joke among them.
Mm-hmm. And again, that's stupid jokes often act as connective tissue, and I think that pretty much covers it. You know, when it comes to stuff like that. Like, my own personal experience, I got quite a few, but I don't think I'll just bring up one. I was in a campaign where I was playing a white kobold and another buddy of mine was playing a black kobold. Through some sort of wacky part of the story, he ended up becoming a dragon. So he started basically setting up an extortion racket of other kobolds. And my line was, kneel before your god. Basically, I was gripping heavily from Stargate at that point.
Stargate.
That and Reboot probably have the most pop culture references for the pound for what they're producing. That and Farscape.
Yeah, I actually heard that they're planning on doing some new version of Reboot.
Yeah.
Except the description they described, I'm like, that's lame.
Yeah, that's not Reboot, man. But yeah, I will give it the benefit of the doubt. But for me, Reboot is one of my childhood shows. Okay. Well, maybe not so childhood, but you get the idea.
Right.
It is some fantastic storytelling, even if the graphics haven't held up. I'm hoping I'll have my it's not oatmeal moment. Okay, it's good, but it's not oatmeal. Or not reboot, so to speak. But we'll see.
Yeah, the description I've seen, I'm like, no.
That dude, I'd never want to meet the users in reboot. That's like, that's just no, bad. Bad Dobby.
Yeah. So no reboot. Okay, so why don't we hit the Kickstarter so we can get this episode closed out? How about that?
That works.
All
And so
right.
we just said the Kickstarter roundup.
Yep, the Kickstarter roundup. I don't know why, but I just saying that makes me want to have like, some sort of yeehaw or something in there.
No worries, man.
Or
The only street loving.
start playing, Raw, the theme from Rawhide.
Oh, man, that'd be awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't play that for copyright reasons.
Well, for obvious reasons.
Royalty reasons.
Yeah. If you really want to hunt it down on the web and you play it in between when you push pause.
Hey, you know what? You can always get Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi did a version for the Blues Brothers.
Oh, that is an awesome movie.
Screw it, screw the sequel.
Yeah, I never saw the sequel, and probably a good thing.
Yep. You didn't miss anything. So first up, I'm going to talk about the Forest Kingdom Campaign Compendium for 5th Edition. Where are we here?
Yeah, I see it.
Yeah, I'm looking for it because it's all. I have my stuff in the wrong order. Ah, I just closed it. That's just. There we go.
Well, they made their money. They only wanted 4,000. They made 22,554. They got 7 days to go. And
Yeah.
it looks like it's just well,
I
it's a
mean,
supplement.
yeah, the artwork looks kind of interesting. The stuff that they have showed. But it is, I guess, for some play, basically, it's kind of a supplement for any place that takes place in a forest, from what I could gather. So, but they have two wilderness adventures in it, a buttload of spells and items, and I'm happy for them. It's just, I have this problem with D&D and even Pathfinder, where, and this is just my, I'm not saying, it also has to do with like, you know how Pathfinder, I mean, Paizo has their RPG All-Star every year.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's like one of the things you have to do is you have to create like unique magic item is one of the things. And it's like after a while, I'm like, at a certain point, all magic items are. I don't care. It's just like, it gets tedious. And I'm
Well,
not
the problem
saying,
is
it's like how
every.
unique can you make at a certain point, is my point.
Yeah, I tried a while back. I created a random. Because there's not that many, I decided to build an apparatus because there's only one I know about. I took a barrel, I stuck a punch guard in, and basically had a killer barrel. And, I thought it was original, but apparently nobody else did, so whatever.
What's really bad is, at least for this Kickstarter, $30 for the PDF. That I'm happy that it got funded, but I'm not spending $30 on a PDF. I'm sorry. I mean, when you look at what their pledge goal was of $4,000, and obviously they've surpassed it, I can't justify spending $30 for just one PDF. And it's
No, that's true.
$45 if you want both the Pathfinder and 5th edition PDF.
Yeah.
And if you
Well.
wanted, and here's the funny thing, it's like for $20 more you can get the hardcover. So $50 for the hardcover.
Yeah, if I were to support this, I'd go right for the hardcover. I
Yeah, I mean,
wouldn't.
there's no point in it. I mean, obviously it's going to be thick, and at least from what they show for the cover artwork and stuff, it looks like it's gonna look nice.
Absolutely. Better
So,
drawer than
and I
not.
mean, and they've clearly unlocked a whole bunch of, stretch goals. I'm starting to get, this is going to sound weird, but I'm, or they call them bonus goals, but they're stretch goals. I'm kind of getting tired of the stretch goals and the Kickstarters. It's become a weird thing where it's like initially on, oh, that's kind of cool. If they make some more money, they'll put some more stuff in for the same price. But now it's like, it seems like, oh, you know what? There's some other stuff we're going to do, but unless we meet this, screw you guys. That's almost how I'm taking it these days.
Well, it's more than that, Mammix. Just realize that every time they make a stretch goal, that's adding time to the product. Because I don't know about you, but if I were trying to build a bonus beastry Ninjargon Wild, that's going to be another 3 months of production.
Right. I don't know. It's just one of those things. I guess I'm just tired of, you know what, I want a straightforward Kickstarter where one product, one threat, one goal. It's like, if you want to do other stuff, do a different Kickstarter. Don't like tie it in. I guess I'm getting a little tired of all the tie-ins.
Well, at least they're out of the buying a mug or random novelty item now.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's a lot of Kickstarters that died not because the product wasn't good. It was because they had to figure out how the hell to order a hat.
A hat. So. But speaking of interesting things, though, where is this one? Jeez, did I not put this one in here? I have it listed, but I don't see it on. That is unfortunate. I don't know why. I have it in the show notes for Sly Furish's
Fantastic Adventures?
Yeah. And I don't have my link to it. This is horrible. I don't know how the hell I did that. That's okay.
No worries. We have the internet. We'll find it.
Yeah,
in fact,
I know.
I have it in front of me here.
No, I have the link, but it's in the show notes. But it's like, I don't know why I didn't call that up. That's just so weird. Okay, so we have a book of 10 short adventures for your 5th edition role-playing game. He was only looking for $4,000. He has 14,000. And, you know, here we go. $15 for the PDF. Okay.
Yep.
That's maybe a little... I still would prefer about 10 bucks, especially for adventures. But, you know, 10 adventures for 15 bucks, that's $1.50 an adventure. Okay, I'll go with that.
Yep. Oh, and just of note, this is Mark Shea, the same guy that we talked about his survey.
Yep. Yeah.
A couple of months ago, so...
Yeah, he's a good guy. I've run into him at Gen Con at least twice.
Mm-hmm.
So...
You at least know you're getting somebody of quality because his blog is pretty amazing for the most part.
Oh, yeah. No, he does good work.
Yep.
So, and actually, I mean, for $15, I mean, just even the artwork that they're showing looks amazing. So, you know, and don't get me wrong, people. The adventure is more important than the artwork, but I know a lot of people get really hyped on the artwork. You know, I'd rather have more material and less artwork sometimes, but I've had people go like, I really need the artwork to imagine. No, you don't. But if you need it, there you go.
Exactly.
You know. I don't know. Have you ever got like that? Where you're like, why are we talking all about artwork?
Well, the few things I've produced over the GM's Guild, that's the thing I'm always fighting with is I can't draw, but I need art.
Right.
And so you try to find public domain material or stuff that's already stock art, but you also don't want to use it like just straight, if that makes any sense.
No.
Because, you know, if it's the same picture that everybody and their dog has, it doesn't have any feel.
Nope. But, no, I get it.
And I respect it. God knows I wish I could draw as half as good as these guys here. And mostly it's just a matter of... Well, I think the best example I can see why you might need art in a project is actually an old favorite, Expedition of the Barrier Peaks.
I'm not saying you don't need artwork in certain things, but I think where I come from is the standpoint where I've had people tell me that it's like, if there isn't good artwork or if there's no artwork in the material, then I'm never buying it.
Yeah, that's a little bit of snobbery here because ultimately we're gamers. You should have good imagination in the first place.
Yeah, or I've had people tell me that, you know, if there isn't good artwork, there's no point in buying it because, you know, how good can the rest of the material be? And I'm like, I don't know. Did you peruse it? Did you read it? And I mean, granted, you can't really do that with the Kickstarters. You have to do that more with, obviously, purchases, like in a store.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I look at the original DMG. You know, a lot of people wouldn't have bought that based on their standards today. And some people say, well, you know, we have all this technology to print things. I got news for you. I actually find a lot of the modern rule books hard to read.
Yeah.
Because they're not black and white pages.
Yeah, my personal preference is to keep the busyness to a minimum in the book because those really nice inlays, I shut them off almost right away because I can't read them.
Right. All right, so let's get on to the next one so we can kind of get going here. Underworld Races and Classes, 5th Edition and Pathfinder. So if you like Underworld Races, I guess this is your Kickstarter. And it's, again, this $25
mm-hmm.
for the Kickstarter.
Yep.
The PDF. And I guess... Again, this is another one that has some stretch goals. for stuff.
Skippers.
And they can't. What were you saying?
Well, you could already tell they created a few of their own races that they seem to be particularly proud of.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, that's it. There's a lot of races, and so they show them, and I'm just like, okay. Honestly, I do not need another supplement that talks about Drow.
I'm not disagreeing with you here.
You know. They have these fungus people. Finally, a use for those fungi miniatures that somebody was making.
Absolutely.
You know, and I mean, some of these, like I said, I mean, some of these really do remind me of stuff I've already seen somewhere.
Well, you get to a point where I'm pretty sure somebody's done it first on just about everything. The trick is what they are going to do with it. Maybe they can put a unique spin on it. Like, Zilwark is kind of a weird concept, but I don't know. I'm sure somebody likes it because they made their funding, so well done.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm not. I mean, the general artwork, again, looks good. And it's like, I can't. I mean, obviously, there's like, you know, when you actually go down, they talk about four of the races are just various types of dwarves that are different.
Mm-hmm.
So, and, you know, obviously they have some additional classes as they talk about here for stuff and.
Yeah, and
I guess if you run a campaign where everything is mostly underground, then sure, why not? And you know, $25 isn't bad. I'd have a hard time buying it, but for a PDF.
But I guess if it's your cup of tea, go for it.
Yeah,
it's definitely if you know this might be good as a supplement for somebody who's running through that Out of the Abyss, that fifth edition thing that came out.
I guess here's what I'm going to look at here. Okay. There's 400 backers. That means the average backer looks like he spent about $58. So.
Okay. So they want their hardcover something fierce.
So a lot of people want the hardcover.
Yeah, I don't blame them for that.
I'm not saying they all did that, because obviously there's some lesser or knower. I always love to do that. Look at the money and then divide by the number of people that back just to figure out what their average is.
Yeah.
That's just
It also gives you an idea what they were most interested in. It looks like these guys really wanted their hardcovers.
Yeah.
You know, bear in mind there might be all guys who just bought $5. There's an awful lot of them, but unlikely, you know.
Very unlikely. There's always going to be a variation there. So next we have up, I like this, because we're seeing a lot more of these. Tsunami Con 2017 in Wichita.
Yeah.
So.
I like guys, for the most part, you know, these are the guys that do the podcast of Metagamers Anonymous.
Mm.
You know, they know their stuff, and you know, seem like pretty cool guys for the most part. And they managed to. They had trouble last year funding the sucker, so I kind of want them to do it this year if they can.
Yeah, I mean, 15 days for a day pass—that's about good. $20. It's weird because a day pass for Friday or Saturday is 15, Saturday's 20.
Mm-hmm.
They still have some 3-day event passes for $30,
mm-hmm.
which is kind. And even if you do just a regular 3-day, it's $35. That's not bad for a convention.
Absolutely. And
I forget, what the hell was Gen Con's last year?
I don't know, but it was probably a pretty penny.
Yeah, and I'll say this again. I think Gen Con's gotten so big that I don't think most people that go there can really enjoy it anymore.
Oh, I got numbers for you.
Nope.
Badge type, Thursday, pre-registration price is $55, and then it goes up to $75.
Yep, there you go.
So it gives you an idea for perspective here, how much you're going to be saving. Plus, the smaller cons, you're more likely to network, meet locals, and get involved with people here. So.
Yeah, I think my thing is, in the smaller cons, I think you enjoy gaming again.
Yeah.
You know, well, don't get me wrong, the Gen Con was fun, and... But for RPGs, I'm not seeing it as much anymore. It's actually better to... I mean, Gen Con's great still for the classic miniature games because, man, the miniature floor was the most exciting place to be. Just from what people had out and using was impressive.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just my opinion. But yeah, so this Tsunami Con is October 6th, 7th, and 8th in Wichita. And it is at... The Winchester Scottish Rite Center.
Yeah, that building looks amazing.
Yeah, I think it's kind of cool looking. It kind of looks like a castle. It actually, see, this would make you want to go because it's like, hey, I'm gaming in something that looks kind of like a castle.
Yeah,
That's
plus
kind of
that's a
cool.
unique element there.
What was that?
Yeah. Oh, I like the feel. I like the backdrop. Like, if I wasn't willing to actually go down to the States and go, spend sizable chunks of cash, this would definitely be on my short list here. Cons I'd like to go to. So, but ultimately, I guess it comes down to how much money do I really want to spend right now. But if I were somebody in the area, you're darn right, I'd be throwing money at them right away. Or even if I was just a couple states over.
Yeah. We also have another convention, ArcadeCon
Sure.
2017, 5th edition tabletop, and Dayton, Ohio is what they're saying. And when are their days? They're November 10th through the 12th.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And so they're looking for.
Oh, this is a catacomb. Oh, yeah, this is the one done by the RPG Academy. Like, between this and DesignyCon, these are probably two of the bigger cons that were created by podcasters. So, like the man says, if you're having fun, you're doing it right. So, it'll be fun to see if they're able to pull this off, to make sure they get all their people together.
Yeah.
Because they really bust their humps to try to get everybody over there.
I guess the early bird convention badge is $35. And I guess that's what it is. It's like if you're pledging at this level, you're either going to be a vendor or you're trying to just register early.
Yeah.
Because
And
I don't see one where when all those early birds are out. But they're, I mean, that's like 500 backers is what they have set aside for the early bird convention pad, so.
yeah. And the one thing I'll notice about a catacomb is they actually already have guests lined up. Guys like Kenneth Hite, James D'Amato, Will Hindmarch, Jim McClure, Tim Wagoner, and apparently many, many more. So,
Oh, and they're going to have the infamous Artemis Space Bridge simulator there, too.
Oh, wow. That could be fun.
Yeah, I've always wanted to try that. But I mean, you know, somewhere, somehow, but I just never really got into that.
Yeah, I think it'd be fun to do once if it's what I think it is. That's the one where, remind me what it's about, and also remind the audience because
It's
I.
basic. It's basically being the a Star Trek bridge crew without actually being Star Trek.
Gotcha.
And so each of the stations actually does something. Like you have a navigation station, you have an engineering station, you have a command station, you have a weapon station, you have a science station, or something like that. So different people interact in different things, and so it's interactive between those people.
That's
So,
freaking awesome. Yeah, and you can already see they have like a big LED TV as
right.
the
Well, it was
main.
they built it so that you could actually have one station with hooked up to a huge monitor that would be your like main just display. So
Yeah, looks
it's
awesome.
actually kind of cool. I like the fact that they make a note that they're not actually costing it doesn't cost anything to sign up and use it compared to I know at Gen Con they charge an extra fee, I think. So
Yeah, and again, this one looks like, another one of these small cons that's being set up by people who are in a very specific area. So, like I said, if you're local and you're within like a state or two, consider it if you're a gamer because you might have a lot of fun. You might meet a lot of really neat people.
All right, let's go through this first. So, Sean Patrick Fannin, is that how you pronounce his name? Fannon?
I think so, but it's been a
Yeah.
while.
Yeah, he's producing Shannantar, Thundering Skies RPG campaign.
Okay.
And it is for Savage Worlds. Which I think is kind of interesting. You know, I'm always a Savage World person.
Absolutely.
I don't know if I would actually buy. I probably won't back this one because I got other things to do with my money these days.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's nature of the beast, so to speak.
Yeah, they still got about 7 days to go. And for $20 is the adventure, and $40 is the PDF of everything.
Yeah, there's one left for the Storyteller Early Bird. Otherwise, you got to spend $45 for the
Oh, yeah, good point.
thing there. So,
Pricey.
if you hear this, there's a good chance the Early Bird's taken up, but you might get lucky.
So, just kind of an interesting thing. I like that.
Yeah, I like the book design. It looks kind of fun.
Again, this the only my only problem is okay, $45. I mean, I don't. There's a lot of stuff, but it's just like, oh, 45 actually is the soft cover. I don't think he has. Or is it just $20 for the PDF period?
Yeah, it looks like
No.
it's complete something in PDF format, plus as well as PDF stretch goals for $20.
Okay, so there you
Not too.
go. That's actually doable. I'm thinking, God, for, so $45 for the soft cover, 20 for the just the PDF. That's doable. So, all right. So next up, we have the Dungeons and Dragons 5th Edition modules. Places, by the way, 2 and 3. I don't remember number one. Do you?
Not at all.
So they reached their goal. They were only asking for $250. So their PDF copies of Limited Edition of Treasure of the Rocks, $15 basically for both of them. Because I guess there's two adventures. Yeah, that's not too bad. $750 a piece.
Well, again, you can always use more modules, even if you have to tweak them a little bit.
Well, I always say, if nothing else, use the maps. Maybe some ideas from it is always kind of cool.
Oh, absolutely.
So we actually have, let's see, Alternity 2017, a science fiction RPG.
Is that the same alternative I'm thinking of? Hang on. Gygax's old toy, or the one that TSR put out a while back.
Don't know. I couldn't quite get that from. I don't know if they're just using the name, which I find weird.
Yeah, they're talking about 1997. Bill Slotsvig and Richard Baker created the original Alternity game.
Okay, there
So
you go.
this was the one that was put out for TSR near its death knell. So, basically was trying to set up one. I think they even did a Gamma World version of it on this game, using this game engine. So it looks like Sasquatch Games is trying to put it out 20 years later.
So $25 for the core rule book in PDF format, and then $40 for the hardcover. And they get 17 days to go. They're about I don't know what is that. They're asking for 35,000. They're at 29,000 and some change right now. So they're about
Let's
like
do it.
75%, 80%, something like that. That's doable.
Yeah, it's definitely tempting due to nostalgia value, but we'll see. That's one of those 24-hour wait moments.
So, this one's actually already funded. Aces and Eights Reloaded, a Wild West role-playing game. And this is the, this is the second edition of the one from Kinzer and Company. I've never played the original Aces and Eights, have you?
No, I have not, but I've listened to a couple of Let's Plays of that just out of morbid curiosity. How do I put this mildly? It's a very crunchy game. If you like a certain type of gameplay, you will absolutely love it. But this is a game that reminds me of Oregon Trail, the role-playing game. You've been warned.
Yeah, well, what I find interesting is that there's a game aid apparently that determines where you roll a d20 and use cards to determine where you shoot.
Yeah, they use a crosshair, which is actually pretty cool.
Yeah, that's a little scary.
Yeah, unfortunately, the nature of the beast is
A little too complicated for me.
bullets will kill in this game, even if you survive, even if you win. Like, you get shot, your character, if you're lucky, is out of commission for about a week, and if you're not lucky, you're dead.
Yeah.
So, like, when I say Oregon Trail the game, I mean you might survive, even if you survive the bullet hole, there's a good chance you might get like an infection.
Yeah, this is one of those ones where, yeah, it's interesting. I just can't do it.
Yeah,
So.
like this is something I want to watch more than I actually want to play, but I am a fan of both Jolly and Dave Kenzer, so I wish them very much good luck on this sucker since they funded. Apparently, I'm not the only one.
Yeah, I just. I'd rather, honestly, at this point, I'd rather, obviously play Deadlands straight
Yeah.
without the strangeties or something.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's relatively easy to tweak a game engine and take out the esoteric stuff.
So here's a weird thing. This go around, there are three products that involve dwarfs. I guess four if you consider the earlier underground one.
Okay, that's a lot of dwarves.
Yeah, first one is dwarves, military, science, fi, and a fantasy world RPG.
Okay, that's cute.
So, super soldiers awaken in a post-apocalyptic, post-apocalyptic fantasy world and must fight to survive. So, they say they have dwarves, meaning something weird, but
Yeah, they're obviously doing a play on words here when it comes to this sort of thing.
yeah, it's a and a little tongue in cheek, I'm sure.
Yeah,
So it
well, it's
has,
already gunning down orcs with modern weapons.
So they have, their own lore rule system, and they're asking for $4,300 US, and they're about halfway there.
Well, we'll just wait and see. What sort of game engine do they use, anyway?
I'm guessing their own,
Yeah.
because it doesn't say anything other than that.
Oh yeah. Oh, here's what they do. They use XBID. They
I'm.
choose the best three dice. Best dice, normally three of the total dice you roll.
Hmm.
So it's basically a roll and keep system of some sort. Okay, so that's kind of neat.
So, next up, there's actually two different dwarf miniatures
Oh my.
sets out. First up is Captain Redbeard's Pirate Dwarves.
Okay,
And this
pirate
is,
dwarves.
yeah.
Yeah, I'm not gonna argue with
Well,
that. That's
actually,
I
you know
like pirate
what? This
dwarves.
one is done.
Oh wow. Okay.
I must have missed it by a day. I didn't notice. I must when I it was available when I clicked it, and it must have been short.
Well, they made their funding, so well done.
Yeah. And then the other one was actually this one funded too. How
Ha
did that? That's weird. So you have these two dwarven nautical ones because this was pirate dwarves again.
Yes.
That was kind of weird. All right, so we won't talk about those.
Other than well done to those who bought.
Yep. And last up, we have The Secret of Innsmouth Act 3, Metamorphosis. I kind of remember one of the earlier ones. I don't know if we talked about Act 1 or I don't remember seeing Act. It was either Act 1 or Act 2.
Well, I remember us talking about figurines for The Secrets of Innsmouth. It may be related to this, it might not be.
I think that was part 1 or 2.
Yeah, sounds about right.
So this is part 3. And they have miniatures here, and again, wow. Highly specialized, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, if you ever wanted to use deep ones in your game and have accurate miniatures, this is the pot thing for you.
Yeah, they have clergy and police and kids and civilians, and I kind of like the hybrid sailors.
Yeah, they are kind of cute. They kind of remind me of that old children's book, Frog and Toad. You know, they kind of have that same look to them.
Yeah, they have about 3 days to go, so by the time everyone listens to it, maybe just a couple of days. They've reached their goal. They're only asking a few hundred dollars, so that's about $35 US will get you 10 figures from Act 3, the deep ones, and they have different things that you can get. So
Yippers.
I don't know. Again, kind of cool. I don't know if I'd get them.
Well, again, if you're a Lovecraft fan or you just want, I don't know, more colorful Kuo-Atoa in your game, this is the product for you.
All right, so anything else before we kind of close up?
The only thing I say is, in Knowledge of Easter, if you have anything involving killer rabbits, let us know. Or if you have anything on the weather or your own personal Easter eggs, let us know as well.
Yep, there you go. And you can also send us an email anyway at info@rpgsircus.com. You can go to our Facebook page, post something there. Go to our Google Plus page for RPG Circus, post something there. And if you go to our RB Circus homepage, of course, you can click on the link to send us a voicemail message, which we'd be more than happy to listen to.
Indeed.
So, and I think that's it for the episode. So we will see everyone in probably 2 weeks then. I think that's right. Let me check the calendar. There's always something weird. That would be the 1st of May, so no, that's fine. I think we may. Around Memorial Day, we may have to skip an episode or change the day that we record. So, we'll
That's
discuss
true.
that. So, we'll see everyone in 2 weeks.
Yep, cheers.
RPG Circus is released on a Creative Commons Attribution US License 3.0. For more information, please visit creativecommons.org.